Good morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show. This story was first published on March 31st of 2019 under the headline, Prepaid Shanghaiing Plot Went Off the Rails Fatally. Here we go. Most of the time, the shanghaiing of sailors in old Astoria and Portland was a spur-of-the-moment kind of thing. It was resorted to when a ship captain needed a crew for an imminent departure and the shanghaier didn't have enough legitimate sailors staying at his boarding house who could be forced to ship out. But there was at least one sailor who arrived in Portland with his shanghaiing already planned, premeditated, and paid for. And it probably would have worked just fine if he hadn't foiled his would-be shanghaiers by dying on them. Frederick Kalashua was a big, burly Finn and no ordinary sailor. He was a ship's carpenter and apparently a pretty good one, so he was far more valuable to the captain of the ship he arrived on, the 190-foot British bark Candidate, than the average sailor would have been. When Kalashua arrived in Portland in late June of 1886, he was angry with the captain of the Candidate, and he didn't seem to much care who knew about it. The skipper, he said, had fed him very poorly and forced him to share a cabin with a black man. Although the captain had promised to move the roommate to other quarters and to improve the food, it seemed Kalashua was enough of a racist that having been forced to share his quarters with a black man had been an unforgivable insult. He arrived in Portland ready to quit. And when he checked into Jim Turk's boarding house, he immediately put his name down on the list of sailors seeking other berths. He also asked one of the boarding house runners, Pat O'Brien, to go to the Candidate and get his box of carpentry tools, which were his own personal property and valued at about $250. That's about $7,000 in modern money. O'Brien tried, but the captain refused to let him take the tools. He, the captain that is, had no intention of letting his carpenter leave his employ and had made arrangements that he was confident would ensure that Kalashua was safely back on board the Candidate when it moved on. Those arrangements essentially amounted to a prepaid shanghaiing. The captain had deposited $60 with the British consulate to be handed over to boarding master Turk after the Candidate cleared port with the carpenter Kalashua safely on board. Turk, of course, knew this and was making plans to earn the cash. Unfortunately for everyone involved, he was depending on a big dumb thug named Daniel Moran to implement those plans. On July 8th, Moran went out drinking with Kalashua. As Moran knew, and maybe Kalashua did too, the Candidate was scheduled to depart at the next high tide, 3 a.m. the following morning. Moran was working to soften the big Scandinavian up a bit. Over the course of the day, Moran would later testify, the two of them wandered the waterfront, soaking up drinks, 30 or 40 apiece, if we can believe that. As they were making the rounds, Jim Turk asked Moran what he was doing.
"I'm going to fix this fellow off,"
Moran replied, according to Turk's testimony, and resumed bar hopping. Near supper time, Moran decided it was time to do the deed, so he chirped, "Let's take another drink," and led Kalashua and several others to a nearby saloon owned by James Kelly. Unbeknownst to all, he had made arrangements with Kelly to slip Kalashua a Mickey Finn. It was about to be night-night time for the big squarehead who would be waking up the next morning aboard the ship he so wanted to leave with the captain he so hated. Or so Moran thought. But Kalashua was feeling sick from all the booze. He staggered to the edge of the sidewalk, vomited in the gutter, and then followed Moran into Kelly's saloon where he declined to take a drink, asking instead for a glass of soda water, meaning a bicarbonate of soda, to soothe his upset stomach. This probably was the moment when things went off the rails. Moran and Kelly had made arrangements to drug Kalashua, and those arrangements almost certainly involved a bottle of whiskey laced with a carefully measured amount of opium, but Kalashua wasn't drinking it. So instead, Kelly had to sneak and dump some opium in the bicarbonate of soda, estimating the dosage on the fly. He then added some sugar, stirred it up, and handed it to Kalashua and told him to drink it up quick. Kalashua did. Then he returned to the boarding house, stretched out on the sofa, and did not move until the death throes came. He died a few hours later, and by that time there were three physicians on the scene, all of whom agreed he'd clearly died of an opium overdose. Now, incidents like this weren't as common in 1880s Portland as popular legends would have us think, but they weren't exactly uncommon either. It's debatable whether the death of some luckless hobo or laid-off logger in a Shanghaiing overdose would have received much, if any, attention in the newspapers. But the involvement of the British consulate and the status of the victim as a skilled marine craftsman combined to give this story some legs. The ensuing trial was covered fairly extensively in the Morning Oregonian, although never on the front page. Authorities soon had both Moran and Kelly in custody. Moran, who had a great deal of trouble keeping his hands to himself, made things easier for the cops by getting himself arrested for picking a fistfight with Pat O'Brien shortly after the doping. So he was already in the slammer when the rap came down. This gave him a leg up on what turned into a race with Kelly as each jockeyed to be the first to flip, turn state's evidence, and squeal on the other. By the time Kelly was in custody and offering to do so, it was too late and he was on the outside looking in. And so, in early November, saloonkeeper James Kelly found himself in court answering to a charge that was probably going to send him straight to the gallows, first-degree murder. Although the death had been an accident, because it had happened as a result of Kelly committing a felony, kidnapping, the statute called it Murder One. Things were looking extremely bleak for Kelly as the evidence was presented. It was pretty clear that he had, at Moran's request, spiked Kalashua's Alka-Seltzer with a fatal overdose of opium. Moran, in the full confession he'd offered in exchange for leniency, had already testified that Kelly had leaned over to him after the doping and whispered, "I think I have given him too much, but never mind, the son of a bitch can stand it." Then came the moment when Moran was called to the witness stand, and the bailiff went to fetch him and found his cell empty. The jailer had left him in the hall while he went to look for another witness who, although he was supposed to have been locked up in a cell, had stepped out for a couple of cocktails before breakfast and not returned. While the jailer was out hunting for him, Moran simply strolled out the front door. Everyone was furious with the jailer after this, and the newspaper reporters dropped broad hints that it had been a conspiracy and the jailer was in on it. But there was not much to be done at that point. The judge ruled Moran's confession inadmissible, and a few days later, Moran still being on the lam, the jury ruled Kelly not guilty. Moran managed to stay lost for almost 2 whole weeks. He moved to Wallula, where he was doing a pretty good job of keeping a low profile until the temptation to get into another knockdown, drag-out bar fight became too strong for his feeble intellect to resist, at which point he was forced to leave town ahead of an angry mob. The sheriff's detective who was out looking for Moran soon heard about this and picked up his trail there and finally caught up with him in Spokane Falls. And a week or two later, Moran found himself in court facing the same charge Kelly had just been acquitted of, Murder One. Following a short but eventful trial, Moran was convicted of first-degree murder. The Morning Oregonian was very happy about this. "Moran may now take what comfort he can out of the fact that he has succeeded in saving his accomplice's neck at the expense of his own," editor Harvey Scott wrote in a very crisp editorial after the verdict. "This verdict was much needed. It will put a check upon the practice long prevalent here of doping sailors so as to facilitate the industry of crimping, kidnapping, or otherwise decoying or conveying them on shipboard, so as to get their advance wages. More men than Kelly and Moran have been in this nefarious business at our northwestern ports for years, and it is high time some one or more of the scoundrels hanged for it." And hanged for it, Moran certainly would have been, but for one little detail. Portland Police Chief Samuel Parrish testified that after Moran was arrested, he'd been locked away in a dark cell in solitary for 3 days, and his repeated requests to talk to his lawyer had been ignored. The chief, who had been on the job less than 2 years and had no previous law enforcement experience, testified that no one had actually told him to deny the request for a lawyer, but he'd heard district attorneys grumbling about suspects getting to talk to lawyers and thought this was what was expected of him. All in all, late 1886, not the Portland law enforcement community's most shining moment. Not too surprisingly, the case was overturned the minute an appeals judge learned about this whole lawyer-denying thing. Moran was eventually convicted of manslaughter and sent back to the pen to start a 15-year stretch for the job. Jim Turk, the owner of the Shanghaiing shop, on whose behalf all this dirty work was being done and who would have reaped the $60 reward of it if it had been done properly, was never charged or even seriously questioned. Despite having essentially confessed to having known about Moran's plan to Shanghai Kalashua for him. Apparently, everybody knew it wouldn't do any good. In the Portland waterfront of 1886, the fix was always in. Key sources in this story included works by Barney Blaylock and the Portland Morning Oregonian Archives from July to December 1886. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning around 6 a.m. So yeah, it'll be a couple days before you get your next fix, but I don't have to tell you that Monday morning will be here in the blink of an eye, right? That's the latest from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studios. Now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.